Okay. I think I should start. Thank you very much for coming to my talk. And I'm very glad to be here back at KITP. I gave a talk almost on related matters in 2012, early 2012, but I only talked about QCD with adjoint fermions. So today I decided to take a sort of larger perspective and look to the space of some QFTs that I find most interesting. This is not the most general space. I will be very restrictive again. I will demand some nice UV behavior. So it's either, you know, some asymptotically free theory or some CFT. So, but I will even narrow that down a little bit, and I will be mostly interested with asymptotically free theories, which has, you know, weak coupling, nice behavior at the UV, small quantum fluctuations, but which do you get strongly coupled towards IR. These are difficult things, and let me put a few examples. Probably the most celebrated one are ON models in 2D, for example, CPN model, and principal chiral model, Grassmannian models, 2D. In 4D, you can count Young-Mills theory, most famously QCD, or chiral theories. You can make almost all of these theories. You can give also fermionic content to it. You can put some fermions, and as well as their SUSY partners. So these are, I think it's a sufficiently large list. At least one theory should attract the, you know, attention of someone in the audience. For a given person, there will be at least one theory that he or she is interested. So these are the things that I want to mention. But all of these, as I said, are asymptotically free QFTs. And these guys, this ON and CPN, are vector models. You know, the main degree of freedom are either n-dimensional real vectors or complex vectors. So PCM is a matrix model. And Grassmannian is something interpolating between the two. So it's a rectangular model, but if m is equal to 2, it is like two-column vector. And if m is order n, say n over 2, it's a matrix model-like behavior. So it's interpolating between these two. And all of these things, Young-Mills, QCD, chiral theory, as well as their partners, all of them are matrix models. You can put various fermion contents. You can put some things in them. Now, I should tell you a priori. My talk is about resurgence in all of these quantum field theories, but my target when studying these things was not, you know, I didn't even know the word resurgence. I was trying to do semi-classics properly. But I think to reach to resurgence is sort of, if you happen to ask the right questions, is inevitable. I think within our given understanding of more or less physics and mathematics, it had to be that way. It had to reach to this theory of resurgence, or, you know, geometrically Picard-Lefschetz theory. It has to come to that point when you start to think about these things. And this is sort of grand message. And if you will remember one thing from this talk, and it involves a little bit jargon, But you should remember that the reason that we are facing all of these things is because the standard way that we are treating all of these quantum field theories, when we are doing the standard treatment of all of these quantum field theories with the standard methods that we know, we are always on a Stokes line. Okay? So this is the reason for my title. I called it Living on a Stokes Line. And most of the phenomena that we see is inevitable. There is really no choice. Maybe it is possible that resurgence or Picard-Lifshitz theory may be an intermediate stage in our understanding. Maybe there is a better description, and we didn't reach there yet. So it's also a possibility. Okay. Now I want to mention some of these problems, and actually, one of these things, and we know. We know examples in which it is not a problem, but in generic QFTs it's still a problem. Perturbation theory in almost all of these theories is almost always asymptotic. So, and it's essentially a divergent expansion, asymptotic divergent expansion. This is generic to all of these theories. All the theories I have written down are scale invariants at the classical levels. Okay, so some of them have instantons, and some of them don't. And one thing that we learned from the bigger picture is that this is a superficial separation. For example, in PCM model, it's a matrix field theory. There is no topological charge. Or ON model, for example, ON model with n greater than 4, greater or equal to 4, there is no topological charge. And one is inclined to think that, there is no interesting topology, for example, because there is a priori no quantifier for that. Okay. And very often, the analogies we draw are also superficial. Sometimes we say that a good analogy for Yang-Mills theory or QCD in two-dimension is CPN because it has asymptotic freedom, it has, instantons, interesting large n limit. And this analogy is in reality not so deep. It is to a certain level superficial. The good cousin of QCD or Yang-Mills theory in two dimensions is really principal chiral model. But in principal chiral model, again, there is no topological charge. Historically, there was a saddle. It was called uniton. And no physicists cared about it. Mathematicians cared about it a lot. It's a paper by Karen Uhlenbeck, very famous paper, but no physicist cared about it. And you ended up rediscovering it by using the methods of resurgence, etc. Okay? But now, for the theories which have instantons, okay, people in the past, in the 70s, came up with this set of ideas which is called dilute instanton gas. This is a standard textbook material, and it is something as wrong as it can be in these theories. The reason being, it's called, I said these are classically scale invariant theories. So when you solve the equation of motion, in Euclidean space, instanton equations, there is no scale entry problem. Actually, scale is always a moduli. This dilute instanton gas assumes that you have an instanton here, an instanton there, an instanton there, an instanton there, and typical separation between these instantons is parametrically larger than the instanton size. But I told you, instanton size is a moduli. It can be anything. It can be even larger than your separation. That's also a fair instanton. Okay? There is If you look to problems, they are. If you look to the standard textbooks, they are misguiding in this regard, or standard literature. There is really no dilute instanton gas picture for these theories, for these quantum field theories. Whenever we control the instanton size, then we can build a dilute instanton picture in a reliable manner. Okay.
But did it not use a scalar field which gives you cutoff, right? So, and then I told you,
Arkady, I said whenever you can control the instanton size, you can have the same thing as what you are saying. Okay. And there is a related problem. You can fix this, as Arkady says, by having appropriate scalars with some waves, blah blah, you know, either some Higgs field or some adjoint Higgs field is in the Polyakov model. But in none of these theories, for example, in these QCD-like theories, there are no fundamental scalars. You cannot control. In SUSY, you can control because there are cases in which there are appropriately many scalars which you can tune so that instanton size is under control. In this one, you cannot control instanton size. People would be happy with this model, that model, saying that, oh, there are even no instantons. I am happy. The only saddle in the problem is perturbative saddle, and this is again one of those things that this is the most strong that you can ever be. There are infinitely many saddles, and they are as rich as CPN model. Okay. There is related problem. It's actually related to this. It is something Coleman calls infrared embarrassment. Infrared embarrassment. But it is really infrared E, let me write. E stands for embarrassment, okay? And this is coming from Coleman, but this is really when you try to do, for example, theta dependence of something in the theory, topological theta angle dependence of something in the theory, these instantons for which the size is a moduli gives you something IR divergent, IR divergent, and tells you that it's again a calculation not under control in general, okay? Now, okay, you can control these things by putting the theory, for example, you can take these theories, put in at a finite temperature, and you can say that I can control instanton size. But almost inevitably, in all the interesting theories, okay, let me call this 4, whenever you have the ability to control the instanton size by, for example, by putting it to a box, you usually, in a regime where you have a semi-classical control, I call it semi-classics proper here, a semi-classical control over the theory, you always land on a different phase of the theory. For example, for Young-Mills theory, whenever you have a proper control over the instanton size, you more or less always end on the deconfined phase. And this is not the thing that you want to study. And putting into the box is something that people thought in the past from time to time. I think maybe Gross, Pizarski, Yaffe papers, similar time, Affleck papers are important in that regard. Now, there is a problem which is sort of master of all. So, but it is, I will come to that later. It is something called IR Renormalon problem. And this is a much deeper problem, okay? And I will come to that and I will explain what it is. It is related to the singularities in the Borel plane for the mathematicians, okay? Yes.
Sorry, this is very naive for physics, but mathematically, what do you mean by the size of an instanton? Is it constant multiplying the exponent?
No. It's really, the instanton is a space-time event.
Oh.
It's an event in space-time. And usually, you can look to its characteristic size. It is like a bulb in space-time, okay? And you can measure its size. But you can imagine that there is a length scale in the problem. This size will be controlled by that length scale. But in these theories, these are called asymptotically free theories. For example, in Yang-Neel's theory, there is no dimensionful coupling. There is no length scale at all. So there is an instanton, but it can be any size. Yeah, thank you for the question. You know, please feel free to ask such questions, and I will try to tell you as intuitively as I can.
But this infralapium alone associated with what we call condensate, right?
This is a generation gap, okay? If I were to ask this thing to folks from your generation, they would tell me they are related to condensate. But now, to the people in my generation, they are related to something else, and I will tell you that story today, which is calculable. But these two things, this is again a technical question, but condensate, and I will talk about some fraction of an instanton in a calculable regime. These two things are also intimately related. One of them is sort of semi-classical avatar of the other or something like that, but they are, okay.
So you blame me that to be
talked
too much
old.
I'm sorry.
No, I didn't blame you. You know, I can tell things that he blamed me for, okay, in the past. And, but since I am being recorded, let me not say. Okay, these are the standard problems, okay? The interesting irony is, I think historically we got used to the idea that these problems are separate problems. Okay? I put five of them here, and we thought that maybe you can relate two out of five. In my list, there is actually seven, but I cut off some of them. You can relate two out of five, but in reality, it turns out that all of these things are actually intimately related, very intimately. And the things that solves one of them solves all of them. It's an interesting thing. There is another thing that, at least historically confused me all the time. When I give a reference to a book, that means that I like it, okay? So usually when I say Coleman's book, that means I respect and I like it, otherwise I wouldn't say it. Okay? But even there, for example, if you read it properly, the uses of the instanton section, go to Appendix C and look to the title, you will see that finite action configurations are of measure zero. And I will say, then why the hell do we care about them then? So I think there are many things. He being quite brilliant and master of words, put things so nicely, so brilliantly that we tend to think that, many people tend to think that this is a mature field, okay? And this is very ironic. With this list of problems, I am sorry, it is not even a kid. So this is the status. It's not a mature field. We have to accept this. We have to come to terms, and we have to try to understand what these theories are trying to tell us. Okay. Now, as you can see, my blackboard skills are nowhere near Ricardo. He uses all the colors beautifully, everything is proper, and I cannot do that, okay? So you have to deal with this thing. But he gave a beautiful talk on the resurgence structure in very nice, simple examples. And we can, and he gave a very nice introduction so that I can move on some technical parts more easily. Thanks to him, okay? So why do we care about this list? Because we care about quantum field theory, because we care about nature, the phenomena that we see in nature, either in condensed matter physics or high energy physics. And we want to understand what is really quantum field theory, and what it is trying to tell us, what is its natural language, things like that. That's a very ambitious problem. Even today, it's a very ambitious problem. But maybe we can ask a more modest problem. We can ask a more modest question. So, question. Can we make sense? We make sense. And, you know, 90% of this question is stolen from a title of the Hooft, Can We Make Sense Out of QCD? But I will put a word, semi-classical limit, classical limit of QFT. Okay. But as you can see, this is actually a loaded problem, a difficult problem, because we do not know that a nicely calculable semi-classical regime of QFT always exists. You know, it's actually a difficult task, and this was also something.
You mean there is no Lagrangian
theory? No. Just take Young-Mills on R4. You know, it doesn't have any semi-classical limit on R4. Okay, compactify it. It is asymptotically free. If you reduce size is large on R3 cross S1, you know, it is still incalculable. It is strongly coupled. It doesn't have semi-classical limit. Make the circle, it's asymptotically free, however. Make the circle size very small. Then you can have some calculability and control, but you land on a different phase. So you melt. You go to a different phase. So I want to have something like semi-classicals, but also I put this idea here. I called it adiabatic continuity, semi-classical, and continuously related to the target theory that you want to examine. Okay.
But this is the idea. Use this kind of effective cutoff, you know, like extra field in QCD. Then you can control. I mean, then you do have parameters.
There are ways to control this, but in theories without fundamental scalars, okay, yeah. Elementary scalars, yeah. At least 10 years ago or so, there were no ways, you know, so that's the reason for the list. Okay, now, I need to also check time, right, from time to time. Okay, very good. Now, these are the standard problems, okay. Now, you can write perturbation theory. So you can write some observables in one of these theories. So let's say, okay, these are hard. Can we make sense out of, okay, semi-classical limit of QFT? Let us be even more modest, and let us, instead of QFT, let us put quantum mechanics. Okay, can we make sense out of quantum mechanics? And there are historically two extremely important work in this category. These are from early 80s, and this is coming from Bogomolny and Zinjustan. But I would say that it was very little understood. Let me tell you what they did, okay? So they usually consider double well, but let me instead consider they consider quantum mechanical system, okay? Something like a simple periodic potential. It's a nice periodic potential, okay? So Bogomolny does something very interesting, okay? So in this system, of course, there are instantons. There are tunneling events from here, there, and from there to here. These tunneling events are called instantons, anti-instantons. These are saddles in the problem. It's an infinite dimensional integral, and these are saddles associated with that problem. Bogomolny did something very interesting. He tried to calculate not only instanton contribution to some observable, for example energy, but something like instanton anti-instanton contribution. Okay? So I will not do the calculation, I will tell you the results. The result you get is quite interesting, actually. There are some tricks that he applies. Because of that, we called it at the time Philip Argyris Bogomolnyi's induced-time prescription. But later, in later years, some of these tricks found justification in what we call Picard-Lefschetz theory. But I will tell you the result. They calculate something like this. Instanton, if your theory has some dimensionless coupling, instanton comes out to be A over G. If you have theta angle, you can also put theta angle. Something, the amplitude of it is something non-perturbative in the coupling constant. G is my coupling constant. Okay? And they try to calculate this thing. Actually, you can calculate two things. One of them is you can calculate instanton. Instanton, no sweat. You found something like there are some prefactors. It is proportional to 2A over G. Okay? They try to do this, and if you try to do it naive way, you get nonsense, complete nonsense. Okay. But they did something interesting. In this G plane, okay, this is my G plane. Okay, they first did something completely absurd. They took G to minus G, calculated this object there. It was a sensible calculation. They calculated this object there. And they decided to return back to the positive real axis because our coupling is positive and real. But there was a surprise waiting for you there. You can return it this way, you can return it that way. Okay, let me call this C plus, C minus. And the result was following. There were some prefactors, 2a over g, but the result was twofold ambiguous, and it had an imaginary part. Okay. This is weird. You should really consider this as a disaster, because it tells you that if you do second order in semiclassics, if you go second order in semiclassics, at first order you were happy. For example, you here you found the bandwidth, right? It's good news. So you calculated something non-perturbative. But if you go second order, this should be associated with something like overall shift of the band, you know, the bands at the bottom here. They found that it had a purely imaginary twofold ambiguous part, depending on your continuation path. Let us keep this for a moment, okay? I told you that Ricardo already, this was Bogomolnyi. And Ricardo already told us the interesting stories about perturbation theory. I can do perturbation theory here. Actually, at NC State, I had a postdoc. His name is Tim Suleiman Pasic. And he developed a Mathematica program. If you want to calculate perturbation theory to 1000th order, feel free to use his Mathematica program. It can essentially calculate everything very quickly, you know. I asked him a very specific question, you know, can you do this potential and that potential to 50 order? And he gave me the most general potential with harmonic minimum at arbitrary order, you know. Of course, 1000 takes a day or two, but if you want 300, 400 order, it takes an hour, okay? But the important story is this. So you want to do perturbation theory here. So you are calculating, for example, something like vacuum energy, okay, or vacuum energy some sort is a function of G. So this gives you some A sub n, G to the n. And we are already told that n equals 0 to infinity. So we are already told that A sub n diverges. It diverges as n factorials, okay? Typically as n factorial. It can be n plus 1 factorial, n minus 1, something like that, okay? So what Zinjustan realized was that, yes, it diverges as n factorial, but if you look at it a little bit more carefully, It diverges in a more peculiar fashion. It's not an arbitrary kind of divergence. You know, I call this A instanton action, okay, pure numerical part of the instanton action. It is 2A to the power N. Okay, at leading order, it diverges like that. So it tells you that the rate that perturbation theory diverges has something about non-perturbative saddles in the problem. Okay, so then of course there are corrections here. Let me call it B0 plus B1. It is 2A divided by N minus 1. I will tell you what B0, B1, B2 is. 2A squared divided by N minus 1, N minus 2. These are the subleading. It diverges as n factorial, n minus 1 factorial. All of these bits are there. Okay. So what Zinjusten realized was that if you take this thing, okay, now at this stage this is a formal asymptotic expansion. Okay. But you can put it to a machine called Borel transform. Okay. This is what Ricardo told us in his lecture. And you get a series which is convergent. It has a finite radius of convergence. In this, when you do Borel transform, you go to another space. It's called Borel plane. And you can, in principle, try to construct from this Borel transform the original thing, the physical observable that you want to construct. And that is achieved as Ricardo explained to us by a Laplace transform. But when you do this Borel transform and go to this Borel T plane, you see that for the simplest case, you have some singularities in this Borel plane, some cuts or poles. Generically, they are cuts. If they are poles, there is always a good physical reason. Okay? So this Laplace transform, you can do it in arbitrary way, in any direction, but for this problem, you have to do it this way, okay? So it's an integral 0 to infinity Borel transform is a function of t exponential minus t over g dt kind of integral. I am just using sort of naive thing that physicists are doing, but in principle, you can do it in any direction you want. So the main message of this thing is following, okay? You had something which looked divergent. You dislike it because it is divergent. But in reality, it is trying to tell you something. What it is trying to tell you is given by this machine, Borel transform and Laplace transform. And this thing gives you something finite, but not quite sensible, okay? If you do Borel transform, then Laplace transform. When you do this integral, if there is a singularity here, you will get some finite part. Maybe I should use other part of the board. Finite part, which is happy. But depending on, you go over the singularity, just above it or just below it, you know, encircle the singularity this way or that way, you get from perturbation theories a result which is twofold ambiguous and which looks like this. It looks like two instanton effects, okay? It is twofold degenerates, and it is purely imaginary. Look, this is a physical problem. If you look to its spectrum, it is all real, 0.7 electron volts, 0.8 electron volts. There is no pure imaginary part, nothing, no ambiguity. But you do perturbation theory, it comes out to be divergent. But you do this Borel, Laplace, it comes out to be finite, but with a price. Your answer has some ambiguous, purely imaginary part. You equally dislike it. So it tells you that neither this thing, and I will use a color, okay? I will use a color. Neither this Borel resummation of perturbation theory by itself, nor Bogomolny's original calculation for the two instanton instanton, anti-instanton, are actually meaningful on their own. But then a miracle occurs. And this miracle, what BZJ showed, Bzingerstein showed at leading order, is that this pathological part coming from here cancels exactly the pathological part coming from there. Okay? You know, this is something very profound, in my opinion, in my humble opinion. But story does not end up there. You can say, hey, look, there are perturbative fluctuations around thing, around this thing. The, you know, this is some leading order statement. And there are order G effect, order G square effect, G cube effects, so and so. Okay? You are right. And maybe this cancellation happens just at leading order, and the rest is nonsense. If you go to G times exponential minus 1 over G, it is doomed. But what we showed in recent years was that we can calculate this perturbative fluctuation around these things. Now, these are perturbative fluctuations around a non-perturbative saddle. This thing, that thing, this is the BZJ. But it turns out that these other fluctuations, dQ, so on and so forth, are also controlling the rate that the lower order divergences happen, you know, subleading divergences happen in perturbation theory. So this cancellation, or LV summation of energy as a function of coupling at theta, let's call this theta, this angle, at 0 plus or minus, plus instanton, anti-instanton, theta equals 0 plus minus, imaginary part of this is equal to 0, holds in all orders. We calculated these things maybe up to 10 order or something like that. This is something we call a manifestation of Borel-Eckhout summability.
This is the medianization, is that right?
Yes, exactly. So it is it's tied up with medianization. But here, it takes place in a physical problem in a natural way.
But kind of following kind of particularly Ricardo's presentation and what we video said, for example, if we just consider, say, Borel image of this, right? Then in Borel image, we still have normal singularity, normal non-analytic function in this case as well, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So in this way, all this kind of subtlety are effect of, you know, inverse Laplace, inverse transformation, right?
Yeah. Okay. Now, so this is sort of analysis side of the story. I want to give you, at least to the people who are looking these things in more elementary terms, I want to tell you an intuition about this, okay? A very simple intuition. And if you had some difficulty at some points there, the example I will tell you is very easy. It's very geometrical. I will tell you why is this happening. And this is also something which connects, at least in the simple examples, the idea of resurgence to the idea of Picard-Lefschetz theory. Okay? Okay. Any questions about here?
Actually, I mean, there is something else which would be profound. Eckhout has a huge family of averages that commute. Somehow, this problem either selects medianization for some reason that needs to be understood, or there are problems in which all averages coincide, and that's a deeper structure of the problem.
Yeah. Actually, I think both of these things are possible. Okay, so yes, the answer is yes. So Then we are choosing these things, these paths. I made a choice. Here, this choice of continuation back and this choice of the cycle, they are in one-to-one correspondence. So one dictates the other. So because of that, there is a decision is made there when I did that. But there was one thing I wanted to say. By the way, I think Gerald later at some later stage will give you will give a lecture about these new sorts of resurgence. This is sort of in the category of old traditional resurgence. It connects late terms in the perturbation theory to the early terms around an instanton. But some structure that we got in recent years, they are very intriguing and puzzling. There is also, you know, early term relations, which is much more constructive. This is very hard, but this is necessary for the consistency of the theory.
But in technical talk, if you do this Babel image of this, right, then your perturbation theory, then you are just getting rid of this item, and in Babel transform there is no imaginary part, right?
There is. In the Borel transform, there is a pole, but in the Laplace transform, there is a purely imaginary part.
Right. So, but then you see how it appears, you know, this imaginary part because of this pole, right?
Yes, exactly. Okay. But I want to tell you a very simple example. You know, let me tell you how I felt about this Borel transform, Laplace transform. I said, what is this? You know, why are we doing this? Okay, so, and I sort of never understood it intuitively until, you know, we started to geometrize this picture. Okay, let me give you a very simple example. I may not get every detail right, but I will get the idea right. Okay, let's say you have an integral like that. Exponential minus 1 over lambda sine square x. It's related to something called Bessel function, I think. So, and this is an integral from, let's say, minus pi over 2 to plus pi over 2. Okay. It's a simple integral. It goes from minus pi over 2 to plus pi over 2. Okay. We can all do this integral. It's a function of lambda. It's a very function. It's a simple function of lambda. The equivalent of semi-classics is finding the saddles of the problem. Saddles of the problem, one of them is at 0, and the other is at pi over 2. So everything replicates, okay? Now, saddles is not the whole story. You have to find the steepest descent path associated with the saddle, so that you can write your original integration cycle. Let me call the original integration cycle I interval. Okay. So you have to write this original integration cycle in terms of these saddles. Actually, it turns out when argument of lambda is actually zero, you are exactly on a Stokes line. If you make argument of lambda slightly positive or slightly negative, you are off the Stokes line, okay? And the saddle, if argument of lambda is non-zero, you know, the saddle, the cycle looks something like this. Starts here, goes there, and this cycle looks like something like this, okay? This is when argument of lambda is not zero. But when argument of lambda approaches zero, this cycle becomes, you can rewrite this, this cycle becomes like that. This is exactly when argument of lambda is equal to zero. This cycle becomes like this, and the second cycle, let me call this J1, second cycle goes like that, okay, J2. J1 and J2. Now, you see that if you sum up J1 and J2, this part cancels that part, tails cancel, And this part is just original integration, okay? But let me call this 0 plus. Argument of lambda is 0 plus. If you make argument of lambda 0 minus, the same image comes down to be so J1 minus J2. Okay, J1 is the cycle attached to this saddle here, and J2 is the cycle attached to the second saddle here. So you can rewrite the same thing. Either this tuple, you know, this figure and this coming down, or that figure and this going up. There is two ways of writing it. Now, let me, of course, this is an identity. Trivial integral is either J1 plus J2 at theta equals 0 plus, or it is J1 minus J2 at theta equals 0 minus. Okay? Now let me connect this thing, this story, to the Borel summation. Okay? You see that, first of all, the first thing that you see, when you say the word semi-classics, your cycles, integration cycles, are immediately allowed to go to the complex plane. Okay, they have tails in the complex plane. In this integral, you know, most of the contribution will come from here, and this part will give you a purely imaginary tail, okay, this part. But you see that in this theta, this was at theta equals 0 plus, at theta equals 0 minus, the tail flips. This is same thing as doing the Laplace transform that way or this way. Okay? Either you go above or below. These are correlated stories. One of them is this one, and the other one is this one. So whenever you have this ambiguity in the Laplace transform, there is a singularity, and there is always a Stokes phenomenon happening here. If you go from theta equals 0 plus to theta equals 0 minus, what happens is that J1 goes to J1 minus 2J2, and J2 goes to itself, such that J1 plus J2 cycle goes to J1 minus J2. This is the famous Stokes phenomenon. Okay? So, and this picture is sort of geometrical realization. This integral over the J1 cycle is really your Borel sum. Okay? So, this is sort of geometric intuition behind this cancellation. And you see there is another saddle in the game, and its sign flips. You know, J1 plus J2 integral goes to J1 minus J2 integral. Its sign flips, and there is this automatic cancellation. Okay? So, and I think that some generalization of this ought to take place geometrically in the path integral as well. Okay, very good. Now, this is all good. You can ask, can this ever happen in quantum field theory? The phenomenon that's taking place in quantum mechanics. I should tell you, this is not an easy question. Most likely this is the question why Tuhuft moved away from QCD, because of something that he discovered. He discovered something very profound. He studied Borel transform of the perturbation theory. And if you do that, okay, There is a counterpart of this. Remember, this singularity here was associated at the end of the day with an instanton anti-instanton. Indeed, from the proliferation of the Feynman diagrams, you can deduce that there is a singularity in the Borel plane located at 2 times instanton action. Okay? There is a singularity like that. You calculate it in some way. There is a sleek argument by Lipatov, I think. And you calculate it in some way, and you see that there is a correspondence with the combinatorial growth of the Feynman diagrams and this instanton anti-instanton singularity in the Borel plane. But the Hoof discovered something more interesting. I think for UV renormalons, Gross also discovered the same thing. But the Hoof did it for IR renormalons. So, and he called it, he also gave the name. He discovered that in the Borel plane, there were singularities located, roughly speaking, at 2S instanton divided by some large number. Let me call that large number beta naught. And I called it beta naught for a reason. I told you that these are all asymptotically free theories. They have running coupling, and the running coupling is governed by renormalization group equations. And this beta naught is a renormalization group coefficient, first order coefficient. And for example, in Yang-Mills, it's very famous. This beta naught is 11/3 n. SUN Yang-Mills, 11/3 n. For CPN, it is just n. But for all the theories I have written down here, beta naught is always proportional to n. Okay? So what the Hooft observed was that there were singularities in the Borel plane much closer to the origin and much more important than instanton anti-instanton singularity. This is the thing he called IR renormalon. So how to deal with this singularity? This is the question. So people can come up with, you know, phenomenological models, sometimes ideas related to condensates, so and so. And but I want to take another route, okay? If we really know what we are doing about quantum field theory, we should be able to discover these things. Okay, we should really find a singularity, for example, around this playground. Okay, now, so, but the question boils down to the following. How can you make an interesting quantum field theory, which may or may not be supersymmetric, calculable? Gerald, I have to ask you, how much time do I have? Is it the hour and a half? Okay, maybe I can take 15 minutes or so because I don't want you to bore you to death. Okay, so maybe 15 more minutes will suffice, okay? Okay. Now, I told you, okay, so I will tell you this idea of adiabatic continuity. For example, adiabatic continuity is following. So if you have, in these theories, they do not have controllable regimes, easy controllable regimes. If you are thinking about these theories on R to the D, Euclidean space, okay, R4 or R2. One can do the following, okay? So one can compactify this theory, since these are asymptotically free theories, to, this is radius of S1, this thing is r to the e minus 1 times s1. Okay? You can compactify one of the direction of these theories. The reason we do that is related to the asymptotic freedom idea. And people used to do that for 30 years. There is nothing special about it a priori. So we do that because we know that if you look to the coupling constant in one of these theories, G is a function of energy scale, it becomes weakly coupled at high energies, and it goes strongly coupled at low energies. So in principle, if you go to a regime of the theory in which it is weakly coupled and still keep its touch with your target theory on R4, you can maybe say something interesting about it, okay? So, but as I said, this is not, people did this since, at least in the QFT community, very often this S1 has an interpretation as inverse temperature, and people did this since early, mid-70s to do thermal field theory. And very often, if D is equal 4 or 3, very often there is a phase transition. Whenever the circle size becomes small, you land on a different phase, okay? And if D is equal 2, there is some still similar, it's not a phase transition in a strict sense, because you are compactifying a two-dimensional theory and it cannot be phase transition, but it becomes incalculable in different ways. So the idea of adiabatic continuity is that can we have compactifications in which we preserve, you know, this continuity. As we go to arbitrarily small S1, we can keep the theory under calculational control, okay? And the lesson of the sort of last now 7, 8, maybe more years is that in all of these theories, more or less in almost all of these theories, we can do this, but it requires interesting things. It requires unconventional boundary conditions or some twisted boundary condition or some boundary condition involving fermion number modulo 2, things like that, okay? But in reality, we also view examples of this. For example, in super Yang-Mills theory, take n equal 1 super Yang-Mills, impose periodic boundary condition on fermions. These are supersymmetric preserving boundary conditions. Of course, in 1980, Witten showed that, you know, this thing is independent of L. It is analytic. It is more than analytic. It's a constant. It's an index, okay? So one needs to think this space of partition functions a little bit more freely. Instead of just looking to trace exponential minus beta h, one can look at things like, let me call it Z of L now, things like trace exponential minus LH, minus 1 to the f, or things like trace exponential minus LH with the insertion of some operators. Because one problem associated with the usual partition function is the following. So this is actually, you see, there is a good quantifier if you are in 4N3 dimension and compactifying one circle. You know, there can be a phase transition, and very often it does happen. And sometimes it is inevitable. For example, if you are in large n limit, it's very plausible that for Yang-Mills theory may have a stringy dual. And if it has a Hagedorn growth in the density of states, the existence of such a phase transition is inevitable. It will take place. But you can use these other partition functions, you know, graded according to fermion number or with the insertion of some operator.
To call it Cartesian function is conditional because it's clear that, you know, say...
I said generalized partition function, I said.
Right, but say, periodic boundary condition for him, it's not a partition function, it's an index. Because it doesn't depend on...
Fine.
Well, it is still index, right? Like minus 1 to the power f.
It is an index in supersymmetric theory.
Right.
If you are in non-supersymmetric theory,
right.
It is, what I am telling is that it is still useful.
Because it can allow you to go. Index is useful. Right, but what I'm trying to say is that partition function in terms of physical temperature, whatever, it is still the one which is not periodic boundary condition.
Of course, you cannot do it this way. But, Arkady, okay. I won't say anything. So, okay, but for example, let me tell you something. So let me take, you know, in if you are in d equal 4 or d equal 3, you can do this. There is another way. It is something called double trace deformation, which also can prevent phase transition, and it can keep the analytic structure of the theory intact. Okay. If you are in two dimension, okay, if you look to this object, for example, take CPN model, okay, so you, this object is exponential minus, let me call it L still, E sub N, and you are summing over the whole spectrum of the theory. So if you are at very small L, for example, okay, you want to study, for example, ground state properties, but it does get contaminated with all the higher states at very small L, okay? So it's very difficult to extract physical information out of that. And you can impose a twisted boundary condition. What does it do? So for example, let me, again, as an example, choose CPN, okay? CPN. And on the field, let me call n of x, the CPN field, x1, comma, x2 plus L. Let me impose, it has an SUNF global symmetry. Let me impose a boundary condition twisted by a global rotation. Okay. This amounts to doing the partition function in the following way. So, L, E sub N, and let me put another subscript K here, because say there is a ground state, let's say, which is singlet under the global symmetry. And if it's a continuous global symmetry in two dimension, of course it will be singlet under global symmetry, but higher states will be representation of that global symmetry. And let me label representation by K, and what this index will generate is, will generate some pure phases. So let me draw a picture. Say you have a, I am doing something very similar to the Witten index in purely bosonic theory, okay? So what you do is you have a ground state and you have first excited states and there's an SUN global symmetry, it's a representation of SUN. So you are given phases. This omega matrix is matrix of phases, alpha 1, I, alpha n. And it's your choice of boundary condition. You are given phases to these states. This is, say, the, say this is the fundamental representation of your global symmetry, which are like exponential I alpha 1, exponential I alpha 2, so and so forth. But you can arrange these phases such that all of these excited states do not contribute. Then take that theory, go to small L limit. It is no longer contaminated. You see, then you will be able to extract properties of the ground state, exactly as in the Super-Yang-Mills theory, supersymmetric theory, right? You have some fermionic Hilbert space, some bosonic Hilbert space. Why it becomes so calculable in various limits? One reason is that if you do, for example, things like Witten index instead of partition function, you are not summing over all of this mess. You are projecting to the ground state, picking out this guy, because the summation over these things is guaranteed to cancel by symmetry. Now, the big lesson that we are understanding nowadays is that there are many many useful boundary conditions which allows us to go to the small circle limits of a quantum field theory and which allows us to understand many dynamical problems in this limit. Okay? Is this clear? Okay. And so we came up in a paper, Gerald and I came up with this idea of twisted boundary condition, and this Hilbert space interpretation is again due to Suleyman Pasić. Okay, now, so what happens? Say you took the CPN model, you put this twisted boundary condition, you went to the small circle limit. What happened? First of all, even if you look to the perturbative spectrum of the theory, okay, states, the counterpart of the Kaluza-Klein states, something very interesting happened. And this is something we also see very often in the context of string theory with D-brains on a circle or things like that. Something very interesting happened. Usually, when you compactify a theory, the levels are quantized in units of 2 pi over L. 4 pi over L, 0, so and so forth. And then you go to, for example, the reason that lattice field theory works is because there is some scale lambda, and if you make L large, there are many states just below this lambda, right? If you take L to be very large. And this is the reason that, for example, we are able to simulate these field theories on the lattice and extract useful large volume results. All of these 2 pi over L, 4 pi over L, they go below this strong scale and it emulates four-dimensional theory. But when you put these boundary conditions, something very interesting happens. It is very similar similar to the following. So what happens is that the modes are no longer quantized in units of 2 pi over L, but they are quantized in units of 2 pi over Ln. If you make this choice of alpha 1, alpha 2 judiciously, okay, they become quantized in units of 2 pi over Ln. Okay, these are the perturbative modes. So in a space that there is no state a priori, now there are many states. If you keep L fixed and take n to infinity, this thing becomes arbitrarily dense. So your theory, look, you are at arbitrarily small circle radius, but you fixed it. Your theory, in perturbation theory, becomes equivalent to the field theory on R2. This is the other way that to see that, you know, these boundary conditions can be super special. Okay? Say that?
Nth root of unity?
Yeah, the phases are nth roots of unity.
Yeah, but effectively your length is L multiplied by N, right? Mm-hmm. You take an N to infinity, it's equivalent to large L, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. This idea is sometimes called large M volume independence or Eguchi-Kawai reduction. It's an important theoretical idea that many people thought about. Now, this is one part of the story, what happens. You know, the other part is actually, will tie up to our story there. You study this CPN model, okay, and everything I tell you is at zeroth order approximation are equivalent in all of these theories, more or less. You study CPN minus one model. For example, take an instanton, usual instanton in this theory, okay? With this twisted boundary condition, just change the instanton size moduli. First, with periodic boundary condition, change the instanton moduli. You know, it was a lump, and you compactified one of the direction, and it became a lump, you know, in the reduced theory, in quantum mechanics, it's still a lump. Nothing changed. You know, just changing the size modulus. This is with periodic boundary condition. You take the same lump and you apply this twisted boundary condition. Let me take CP3, so n is equal to 4. You see something very interesting, first of all. This lump fractionates to 4 lumps. And in general, it fractionates to n lumps. Okay? So this is. And the action, and these are in some sense from the lower dimensional point of view, these are like kinks, fractional instantons. So the action associated with these, let me call them kinks, k, is two-dimensional instanton action divided by n. Okay, so in general. Okay, so you have these fractional instanton-like configurations. Now, However, you are still in the quantum field theory. It is circle compact fights, and you are still there. And if you are in gauge theory, all of this story goes through. You just replace these kinks with monopoles, monopole instantons, and things like that. Now, of course, you will not be surprised when I tell you that if you take these kink events and look to their kink-kink bar kind of amplitudes and calculate them by doing integrals over their separation in some way, you discover that this is twofold ambiguous. But the interesting thing, as you will guess, is the location. This has some real part, which is nice. And it also has an imaginary part, I exponential minus 2s2d instanton divided by n times g, okay? Now, actually, the appearance of this n is very interesting because this thing, when you do Laplace integral, was giving you something like exponential minus 2s instanton divided by g. But on the other hand, these things are much, much larger, exponentially larger. So they would be corresponding to exponential 2s instanton divided by beta naught, where beta naught is of order of n. Okay? You immediately see that this thing survives in the large n limits. They are not irrelevant in the large n limits. So these fractional instantons do not fade away in the large n limits. So you can call this two-hoofed coupling here. Two-hoofed coupling.
But when you're talking about this, you're still talking about this fractionalization of instantons.
Yes.
But you can also look at this from the point of view of, you know, spectra itself. So you have CPN model and you have real kink, not a fraction of instantons, but real kink there.
Yeah, right? That's different.
No, I agree that they are different, but you can say, you can associate this instanton, for example, CPM, that they are related to existence of kinks there.
These are kinks of the compact pi theory.
No, it's just the terminology is a bit kind of misleading because they are real kinks.
Yeah. There are solitonic kinks.
Yeah.
They are different. These are kink instantons. So, okay. So these are things which will correspond to singularities in the Borel plane. But now, the interesting thing is that, of course, we are not very surprised by this, but the sort of the nice part of the story is that these things would correspond to the singularities in the Borel plane just sitting there. Indeed, if you study this reduced quantum mechanics and study its large order perturbation theory, you discover that, you know, these things again cancel each other nicely, and these things, at least in the small circle limits, is sort of semi-classical reinterpretation of the two-hoofed renormalon. Okay. Now, at least in this regime where circle is small, let it be either R3 cross S1 or R times S1 or R2 times S1, it doesn't matter. I think semi-classical QFT has a chance to be IR complete in a certain sense. And, you know, one can probably combine these things to make a full sense out of this theory. Okay? So this is what I call semi-classics proper. But I should tell you that, to be honest, fully honest with you. So in the CPN model, this was exactly n, and this singularity coincided precisely with the IR renormal one. But if you go to pure Young-Mills, okay, this beta naught is famously 11/3 n, but there, if you calculate monopole instanton, anti-monopole instanton correlated pair amplitude, it again gives you a singularity at 2s instanton divided by n. So there is a mismatch of the 11/3 versus 1. So it doesn't get you, it doesn't get you exactly the same location of the singularity, but At first, we didn't have the right to expect that they would be exactly at the same position, but we had the right to expect that they would be in the same territory. This should have been our expectations, even to begin with. And the territory is drawn by 1 over n. So numerical factors may or may not match. It's a detail, okay? But this factor of n is the crucial part of the story. Now, I can actually I can wrap up here at this stage. Okay. Let me wrap up here because it's a long way, so I don't want you to get very tired. Yes.
I have two kind of related questions. So how do you interpret the sort of the fact that the closest singularities are somehow inactive in the limit proper?
Closest singularities, they become active. They become important. So
the fact that the first sort of instanton is only at minus psi over g.
This instanton is like a nuance here, okay? These were the important things. And perturbation theory predicts that they ought to be the important things. But these things, these saddle configurations that you find in this compactified theory also gives you, and they in some sense do this medianization trick for them. And they are really bread and butter of the story. In some sense, you know, this instanton is like a fly in the room and this is an elephant. Okay?
The second one is whether there are other ways to compactify what into some finite.
So, in principle, all of these things would you know, contribute in a complete story.
But together, 11/3.
Oh, 11/3. Okay. That's a very interesting question. Okay, so how could that work out? I think there. Maybe you can help us. So I think that maybe something along the lines of the transasymptotics may help. You know, these summation, infinite summation of the non-perturbative factors may change some power somewhere. So this is something that I am very curious about. So, but if one gets that right, you know, it's sort of big deal.
But what the number instead of instead of 11/3, it's just n, so the difference.
Yeah.
It's 11. All 11/3 goes away. It's yeah. It's not like 4n because 4n.
No. Yeah. Actually, I want to say one remark about this 11/3. In the small circle region, we can get 11/3. Okay, so you have this beta function calculation of NSPZ from the instanton, four-dimensional instanton. We can do that analysis for a three-dimensional monopole instanton on the small circle regime. But this 11/3 is something coming from UV. So for that monopole instanton, if you do that properly, you do get 11/3. Okay. But the action of this damn thing, but that thing comes in the pre-exponent for the, you know, multiplying something like Pauli-Willard's to the power 11/3. It conspires the 4 is the number of zero modes of the monopole instanton, and from this determinant you get something to make it 11/3, okay? Yeah. That part works.
Yeah.
But I was hoping if this other part, you know, if this instanton action would also collaborate with it, that would be a big deal. But there is this thing, idea of transasymptotics that Ovidiu used a lot in the past, and it goes is resummation of this non-perturbative exponent, so and so. I think there can be something non-trivial that can be done there. But yeah, I hope we can, so.
The 11/3 over n, is this coming from matching the expansion at the origin and looking at?
Yeah, actually that 11/3 is the reason the famous guy at this institute, David Gross, got the Nobel Prize with Wilczek and Pulitzer. This is the beta function calculation of the Young-Mills theory and QCD. So it is coming from the loop diagrams in the UV. It's a UV effect. Yeah, short. It's coming from short distance.
Question? All right, let's try.